All right. Before we begin this pod, I want to give a huge shout out to all of our patrons over on patreon.com/bitterbrownfems, with special shout outs to Cristian Galindo, Evelyn Preciado, and Cassandra Tapia. You are in our BBF, BFF tier, and I got mad love for you guys. If you want to support the creation of the pod, anything as much as like a dollar gives you an archive to like almost a decade of content at this point. $5 gets you a video episode, $10 gets you a bonus episode. So yeah, check it out. The link is in the description. And let's do it live. Hello, 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 everyone. This is your host, Ruben, coming to you from Portland, Oregon. And with us, we have the multi-hyphenate singer, actress, journalist. You might have seen her on the pages of Vanity Fair, LA Times, Rolling Stone. She is a karaoke queen and self-proclaimed ex-Florida goth. I still think she's a goth, but to each, everybody can self-identify how they want. So please welcome Susie Exposito.
Thank you so much, Ruben. Thanks for the
Yeah,
invite.
did I miss any hyphenate there?
No, I think you covered a lot of the bases, although I am also an illustrator.
Work. Yes, you
I'm
had
just
a
an
comic.
all-around art hoe, you know?
You had a book published recently or in the works?
2 years ago, yeah. I illustrated a memoir for like a grown riot girl called Pieces of a Girl. And it was like a zine style punk memoir that was partly illustrated by me.
I almost added Raya Girl to the beginning of your intro. But I know that there's like technicalities around that. Do you consider
I
yourself a riot girl? Or
feel like I was part of like that Riot Girl revival of like the late 2000s, 2010s. That happened around the same time as like I don't know, there were so many bands back then. My band Shady Hawkins, we were part of like this New York scene that was very much in conversation with Riot Girl, but we were like, you know, Brooklyn queer core, we were part of that scene. And a couple of the members are trans, so we like overlapped with Brooklyn trans core and like it was incredible. All of us, a lot of us met at like Girls Rock Camp, but a lot of us also, you know, in this scene, like diverged with gender. So it was more like, yeah, we were like inspired by Riot Girl in a lot
Cute.
of ways.
Cute, cute. And before I forget, do you have a recession indicator for the people this week?
Oh my God. Okay. A recession indicator is, ooh. I feel like there were so many to choose from. I feel like the romanticism of like, where do I even begin? Maybe I'm seeing a lot of throwbacks to like 2012 festival wear, especially because Coachella is this weekend. And I think as soon as people start bringing out like the cultural appropriation light. There's so many recession indicators though, you know, like I'm trying to think about the strong brows are coming back, you know, little by little. The strong, not I wouldn't say the block brows are coming back. Those are definitely staying in 2016, but the bleach brows are out.
I
The
was
prosperity brows, the super thin, you know, like it's I think of like the 1920s when like the super ultra thin brows were in, and then like the Great Depression hit, and
I
then
never
those of fashion.
yeah, I've never heard of like you called it like a surplus brow or what did you call it? Like
Prosperity
prosperity.
brow.
So that's the thin brow. Did you come up with
Thin
that
or like
term?
the barely there, like bleach brow. I feel like that's starting to phase out a bit.
That's so funny. That's like a brow version of like the le skirt lengths indicator or the lipstick indicator.
Yes. Yes, or like the stripper index.
Yeah, yes. You mentioned Coachella, and to me, that would be my recession indicator too.
Yeah.
I mean, I could talk about that for hours, but I will say like really quick that there was like a article passed that like most people going to Coachella this year, and in the last few, since basically since things didn't, it kicked back up from COVID, most people going are like getting into debt. Like they know for sure that they're getting into debt
Yes.
going there. And also there was this sign like from like a local like politician that's running for election. You know how they have those Coachella billboards? You know, this local politician put his own out. And it was like, you know, are you tired of your bills that they keep going up? Like, vote for me. But he tried to like put it in like Sabrina Carpenter font or whatever.
Yes, I know who did this, just not off the top of my head. It's like woke billionaire candidate for governor. And I, man, my brain is fried. It is a Friday.
And just letting the audience know this is like at the last hour of the workday on Friday.
Yeah.
So thank you for coming in after what's sure to have been a long week.
Oh, such a
You know, back in my day when I first started to Coachella, I think the whole experience cost me like $450 and I just ate like crap the whole weekend, like protein bars and water and like watered down beer. And it's just not the same.
That's how we used to do it, but now a lot of the kids are like, they have like celiac disease, or they have like very or very, very like limited diets, like that
They're
you
looks
can't eat.
maxing.
Yeah, and they're looks maxing, they're on peptides.
So one of the main reasons that I wanted you to come on to the pod, other than like your usual brilliant insights on like the social cultural impact of like musicians, is that you recently took like a trip to Cuba with other activists. You were yourself a part of an activist group. To deliver supplies, right?
I
Could
went
you,
as a journalist, I just
as a,
want to
oh, you went
say.
as a journalist.
Yeah.
Did you want to talk about how that came about?
Yeah. So I heard of the Nuestra America Convoy back in February. They were planning, so it's the same group of people, Progressive International. It's some of the same activists who organized the flotilla to Gaza that it was the boat delivering aid to Gaza. They got arrested by the IDF and beaten up in prison. Greta Thunberg was one of them. David Adler was the leader of the pack, and he decided that we also needed a flotilla to Cuba. He was organizing like another boat excursion with humanitarian aid to Cuba. And I was like, okay, this, I mean, I was very concerned because, as anyone who reads the news avidly knows, there is a blockade, there's an oil blockade against Cuba being levied by the United States. And it's been, it was levied in January after the US intervention in Venezuela, where they managed to ambush the Venezuelan president and arrest him as well as his wife, took them back to New York, and now they are on trial for alleged drug trafficking charges. That's how the US was able to depose of the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, and they installed his vice president basically to take over for him. And now the US is like pretty much operating, it's the US is running Venezuela through Delcy Rodriguez, who was the vice president turned appointed president by the United States. And what this meant was that the Venezuelan oil reserves were immediately under US jurisdiction. And Venezuela was supplying a really like huge, I mean, just a large portion of Cuba's oil reserves. And Venezuela and Cuba were like, besties. Let's put it that way. They've been allies, both. I mean, Venezuela having like a socialist government, Cuba having a communist government. They have helped each other survive all these years. And so once the United States was able to cap oil shipments from or just completely put a stop to them going to Cuba. Cuba was already looking at a massive oil shortage, but then the US Navy has been intercepting any incoming oil to Cuba, and they have threatened tariffs on any other government, any other country that might want to deliver oil to Cuba. So this happened in January. Progressive International, as well as an organization, an anti-war organization called Code Pink, they decided to rally activists to, get to join the flotilla. So it was a number of boats. There were multiple boats that shipped aid, and so I was. For me, I'm Cuban American. My dad is Cuban American. My grandparents came from Havana in the mid 1950s, and I spent a large part of my life in Miami, surrounded by Cuban exiles. So, but at the same time, for me, I think that the situation in Cuba, I feel a bit differently from my family about it. I have been critical of, the United States meddling in the affairs of other countries. I have felt this way since the war in Iraq. When I was in high school and old enough to start reading things on my own and understanding just like the horrors inflicted by the United States in the Middle East, and increasingly more than ever by Israel in the Middle East. Like, I personally have always been of the opinion that military, I think the use of military should be like very, very limited. I have been just, and it's funny because I do work as a journalist. I am a person first. I am a human before I'm anything else. But as a journalist, I think, I mostly cover entertainment. I cover the arts, culture. I don't usually veer into politics. I think whenever I write about politics, it's usually writing about other people and how they're engaging with politics because I do find that interesting. But me personally, I've always been very anti-war. On principle, I think that, the United States has done so much damage throughout the world. And it's like not even quantifiable how much damage the United States has done by intervening in, in different countries. And I just, I believe in diplomacy. Sue me. So that's like where I'm coming from. And when I heard about the oil blockade, this is like, I was like, oh no, oh, this is going to be so bad. Just like as soon as I heard, I mean, as soon as I heard about Venezuela, I was like, oh no, I already knew they were gonna use this as like a stepping stone to also intervene in Cuba. And it wouldn't be the first time that the United States has been entangled in Cuba's affairs. There's been an embargo against Cuba actively, since at least like 1960. There have been a number of sanctions levied against Cuba by the United States. A lot of it was the Red Scare. A lot of it was like, oh no, we don't want to, we want to prevent the spread of communism. But also the fact of the matter is that, America was doing a lot of business in Cuba before then. They had like they were in what's the word I'm looking for? They were working with the predecessor, to Fidel Castro. They were working with the dictator. Oh my God, now I'm like nervous because I actually don't really talk about this out loud. Like, I have to tell you that I don't actually talk about I realized this when I was in Cuba, but I was like, shit, I talk about music all the time with people, but I actually don't talk about Latin American politics out loud. So I'm always like, texting or writing about it on social media, but I'm like, oh, actually, oh, this is weird. I'm not really like a podcaster when it comes to these things.
Yeah. So
But anyway, The thing is that the United States was like very deeply embedded with Fulgencio Batista, who was the dictator that preceded the Cuban Revolution in 1959. And, American businesses were thriving in Cuba, but also like poverty was very, very present. Also, like it was a very segregated society. Jim Crow era United States doing business in Cuba, which is a very black country. And like, the thing is that they wanted to, export a lot of like the American ways of life, and that required a lot of inequality. The literacy rates were really low. There were the opportunities were very limited for Cuban people. They were relegated to a lot of people were relegated to like being, to servitude essentially. And it doesn't, it doesn't surprise me that people revolted when they did, given the levels of inequality, also the, the mob, like the American-based mafia was also operating in Cuba and kind of like sowing a lot of chaos in the years leading up to the revolution. And that's when my grandparents came from Havana to they actually went to New York first. And so my grandfather and his family, they like moved to the Bronx and like worked in cigar factories. They worked in textiles. Like they, my great grandfather opened a bodega, and my Nana, she's so funny. She doesn't, and I wrote about her in my story for the LA Times about Cuba. But she, her mom, her father was actually like killed, in like a violent accident, when she was like five in Havana. So it was just her and her mom by themselves, and things were dicey. So they actually, her mom was a dressmaker and was just got a connection through her cousin with like a factory in Hoboken, New Jersey, and like they moved there. They were able to, secure visas through work. And so this was like in the mid 1950s before the revolution. So like I will say I don't have any like any blood relatives of mine who were, exiled or persecuted after the revolution. My relationship with Cuba is different. It's a little different than people who did experience those things
Yeah.
after the revolution.
And in your article, you mentioned like that it seems that the attitude that like, younger Cubans, that it seems like every generation seems to have like a very different opinion on Cuba and US and like that relationship. Can you talk about how maybe you saw your own perception of that grow or evolve?
Yeah, I think that I always, because of how I grew up and like growing up around people who had been to prison in Cuba, I heard stories, and granted, it's a mix of things. There are people who, yes, like committed crimes or things that would be crimes in the United States, and then like that's why they went to prison in Cuba. But then other people, they were more, they were outspoken. I've met people, even in recent years, it's not like it all happened in the 50s and 60s. Like a lot, there is a lot of repression in Cuba. That's real. There's a lot of repression in the United States, and that's real.
Say
So it's
that.
like, and so it's like for me, yes, I grew up knowing so many people in my community who had been impacted in some way or another. My father's stepmom, her father was a mayor in Cuba, and he was elected under Batista and was put in prison for like, just I don't know exactly what they put him in prison for other than like collusion or whatever. That's something that, I would have to go back to her to like find out, but. She was sent to like a re-education camp as a girl, and like learned how to be a communist, and they like taught her how to shoot a gun. They were training soldiers, and they were training kids to be soldiers, making them learn about Marx and stuff. She escaped. She went to Spain, then ended up in Miami, married my grandfather. And so she's very, very militant. She's very conservative. She's just like super against the government. And I actually tried to interview her for my story before going to Cuba. Like, I really want to talk to you about this because there is a, I was like, there's a movement of people bringing humanitarian aid to Cuba, but what do you think? And she was like, I won't talk to you for your story, because she already knew where I was, like, kind of like, she knew that I was like already probably gonna be critical of the embargo. You know, it's something that my family, they're very conservative. I'm not, you know, I'm someone
Just a little
who
bit conservative.
I just a smidge. I know how to shoot a gun.
What? That's not conservative. That's leftist
I'm like,
talk.
no, it's funny. I mean, again, because I work at the LA Times, I'm technically, it's like actually really crazy. And I am a union member, but I'm not allowed to like say, oh yeah, I voted for this person or that person. Like, I actually can't do that. It's interesting enough, but that's if you work at a newspaper, and the New York Times is actually even more strict. Like, you can't even be seen at like a protest or a rally or anything like that, for these traditional newspapers. So I can't even tell you, like, oh yeah, this is how I vote, on a podcast. But for me, historically, I've been on the more like liberal progressive side of things. And so me and my family were never going to see eye to eye on a lot of things. And I went in knowing this, and I never went to Cuba before. I did consider going during the Obama years when, you know, during the Cuban thaw, when he was relaxing, you know, the conditions of the sanctions on Cuba. So people were able to travel more easily. It used to be more difficult. You know, you'd be kind of suspect if you were a Cuban American visiting Cuba. You know, on both sides of it, they'd be like, are you a spy? You know, like, what do you want with us? And you know, if you were coming from the US to Cuba, and it's, yeah, anyway, he relaxed those relations. I actually, you know, I asked my Nana back in, like, I think 2015 or 2016, when tourism was starting to pick up in Cuba because of the Cuban thaw. I asked my Nana, I was like, do you want to go back to Havana? Like, I just want to go back with you, because I think growing up with a lot of the stories that I heard about, you know, dissidents going to jail, gay people going to jail, anyone who was like gender nonconforming being sent to a labor camp. Like, these are real stories. This really happened. And so growing up hearing that stuff, I always felt I had mixed feelings about people who would go as tourists. You know, I had friends. I like dated somebody who went to Cuba as a tourist, and I just felt like they didn't. It was people who like didn't. I didn't feel like they knew enough. I felt like they didn't have enough context. They were a little too cash about it, and I found that suspect. Just. Because I don't know, and maybe you might feel similarly about, like, I mean, generally, like, American tourists going to Latin America, being disrespectful.
Girl, don't even get me started. But I want to stay on track. You mentioned like LGBT folks, and you in your article, you mentioned Reinaldo Arenas, which to me, I as a kid, I was like 18, 19, read Antes que Anochezca. And that like borderline made me like, yeah, I'm a left, but I don't know about this communism thing. Because of like the way he described like everything he had to go through, it just seemed horrifying, and it just put it in a historical like context of like why are, the marginalized people always like the first to be on the chopping block in these revolutions, right? And I saw that like while you were there as a journalist, like you made it a point to connect with like queer communities, right?
And so, you know, for my piece, it was specifically about the Cuban Americans who went on the convoy. to deliver humanitarian aid to Cuba. And I decided to focus on them because I felt like they were doing something very like bold, especially for our community, like joining a very explicitly leftist convoy, you know, one that was like for all intents and purposes in solidarity with the Cuban people, but also like, you know, trying to, there were a lot of people who went in solidarity with the government, and then there were people who did not go in solidarity with the government, which made it made it so interesting, you know, like this mix of people just showing up for a humanitarian cause. And in within the Cuban American group, I knew that there was going to be a diversity of opinion when it came to the government. But at the end of the day, people in this group wanted to show up for people. They're called the Cuban Americans for Cuba, and it's an activist group that many of the members are based in South Florida. And many, you know, you have to be Cuban American to be a part of the group. But I thought it
They
was
check,
really,
they check.
yeah, they do. They check your credentials. Not really, but I was really interested in this group. When I found out, because I tweeted about the convoy, and this is how I ended up on the convoy, because I tweeted about it and I was like, I have concerns.
So I was gonna mention that as we were talking about, like, in 2015, you saw people go to Cuba as like tourists, and you have some feelings about that. Like, you know, for me, sometimes I feel like, oh, you don't know enough. Like, you're just gonna, do those feelings come up again right now that you were going? Like, of
A little bit.
like what's, you know, kind of G-checking people in your mind a little bit.
Yeah, I think I always told myself, you know, my Nana, she at the time she didn't want to go to Havana because she was like, oh, I've been there before, you know, I want to go to Greece. She's a fancy lady.
Same.
She's a classy broad, you know. She grew up in like New Jersey and worked in the fashion district in New York. So now she's like very, she's so funny. But you know, she's a diva. So she was like, I think I want to go on a cruise instead, you know, in the Mediterranean. That's how she wanted to spend her, you know, wild and precious life. She's like, I was a kid in Havana. I don't know about that. Now she really wants to go. She's 81, like pobrecita. She's like, I think being, especially me going on this trip, I think it made her very nostalgic. But anyway, I always found it a little sus, you know, and also like there were always groups of, you know, like I know Democratic Socialists of America would lead groups like travel groups to Cuba, or like, you know, study groups to would go to Cuba, like different like communist groups would go there, and they would take tours, you know, like guided by the government, and they would get to see, okay, this is how everything works. Like, this is actually how, you know, this is how our government works here. Okay, we're gonna take you to see some jazz. We're gonna take you to see some ballet, but like you're gonna meet a lot of people who work in the government. And so that turned me off again. Given how I grew up, given a lot of the history that I knew and read about. And so I mean, people can beef with me, but it's like at the end of the day, I'm still anti-authoritarian in spirit, you know? It's like I do believe in freedom of speech, freedom of the press. And I think that, you know, just on principle, that's not going to, what I've seen or what I've read about Cuba, and then also like what I saw there, it was like, this is a little iffy, you know, musicians being put in prison for writing songs, you know, like it's just these things. I still have criticisms of the Cuban government, but it's not my government. So how, you know, I'm not gonna like make them
Yeah.
do what I want to do, which is what a lot of people in Miami think that they can do. Anyway, I'm going
Yeah.
off track.
No, that connects to like a piece that you shared from Revista 5W recently. And they talk about I'm translating, but they're like there are leftists that come to Cuba and look at us as a zoo, like a communist, like
Yes.
a zoo of communism. And they go out on these guided tours where like they get this
Yes.
like neatly manicured vision of communism. And I mean, I fully saw that. That is also how I hold that duality of things of like, yes, this is, communism, but it's affected by so much. And you can go there as like a leftist and say, this is wonderful and perfect, but you're being given like an image of it, but that was
It's very
manicured.
curated,
Yes.
right? And that was always my criticism. That's why I never went on those trips. And I remember when I tweeted about the convoy, I was like, I have some concerns about this. But I heard from David Adler from Progressive International. I also heard from Kate Willett, who's an activist. Who organized a press group specifically for this convoy? And they both were like, we would like to extend an invite to you, to join the group of journalists that's going on the convoy. And it was a mix of journalists and like content creators. So like Hassan Piker was one of those who famously went to Cuba, and people were just like shitting themselves
Girl, it's
over.
been like a when how long have you guys been back? Like 2 weeks and like
Three
3 weeks
weeks.
and people and look, everybody's still shitting their pants about Hassan went to
Oh
Cuba. Like,
my
girl, that
God.
yeah, that brings me to like something that you kind of keep mentioning is like you went there as a journalist. Like what and like and I now I'm finding out too that there's like restrictions about what you can say, like what it separates like the journalist experience from like maybe the activist experience, like going there, right?
Yeah, well, we had our own group with like a group leader, and we were nobody on the convoy was beholden to go to anything that they didn't want to. There was a this is wild. I didn't even like My so I will say, like, I will preface this. I am actually writing like a longer essay that is specifically for a book because I gotta have a little something for myself. But my essay for the LA Times, it had to be under like 2,000 words. So a lot of things were like cut out. But there was like a scheduled program of events that kept having to be moved around because there was very limited electricity. We did stay in a hotel a Spanish-owned hotel called Iberostar, which is actually the only legal way that like you can the only legal way that you can patronize a hotel in Cuba if you're coming from the United States is if you go to like a foreign-owned hotel. So the only options that we had as a big group of people because the whole convoy, it was like 170 people total, including the journalists. And they were like, you could stay at like a casa particular or like an Airbnb if you wanted to independently. But the hotel was running on a generator. They had generators running the power in the hotel. And given that, the writers and the content creators needed access to power and internet to like do what we were doing. That just seemed like the best avenue. But a lot of people were like, look at them staying at a 5-star hotel, once people started posting on Instagram and stuff. But that was actually that was the legal way because part of the US embargo requires that you don't actually give money to anything owned by the Cuban government. You can't pay them any money or
Holy
the
shit.
Cuban military. Yeah. So like they're really strict about that. And, I paid for my flight on, my flight was with, it was a chartered plane, with a US company. You can fly to Cuba. Actually, like American Airlines offers flights to Cuba. Still, you can fly to Havana. I think it's like Miami to Havana at least once a day or once a week, but those flights are still legal. It's just when you go there, you are not allowed to pay money to any entity that is owned by the Cuban government.
So how does the like humanitarian aid get around that? Is it like these are gifts and they don't count as money?
Yeah, so like what they and I saw them load it up and load it out and take it to like the hospital, but they had like over 3 tons of medical supplies and medicine like loaded onto the plane. There were also like regular people on this flight to Havana. Like there were like families, you know, like parents with kids. There were people actually they like brought like a couple. I saw like a couple of like big screen TVs, being, like families bringing in big screen TVs because people bring stuff regularly to Cuba, but it's as like gifts, you know. So they'll bring medicine, they'll bring food, you know. You can go to Costco and pack a suitcase, which I mean, what I did was I packed a suitcase that was full of baby food. I don't know how I got it through TSA. I had to fight. leaving LAX, I had to fight the like TSA officers to let me on with baby food, but it technically followed the guidelines. But yeah, and then I packed a bunch of like travel size medicine kits and things like that. You can still do that as like a donation. It's just you cannot pay anybody American dollars, you know, if they're associated with the government in
Yeah.
Cuba.
And I assume they'll track you somehow. And
Well,
what
your
are
Visa
select
card wouldn't work. Like you can't use a debit card, credit card from the United States. It's just not going to work. So I had to pull out cash. I gave most of it away to people. That was also a big part of the humanitarian aid is that like a lot of people, you know, yes, they loaded the cargo section of the plane with like medical stuff, and that was largely coordinated by Code Pink and Progressive International, because they are like running low on a lot of medical supplies. They were already struggling. You know, you hear about in Cuba, like people generally even before like having to bring their own like gauze or something like that to the hospitals because they would have shortages.
And
Because a lot of, I mean, the U.S. really has its like tentacles and. In so many industries around the world, and one of those things is like the medical industry, and you know, all the boxes that were being loaded up, they were all donated through like a nonprofit called Global Health Partners. But all the boxes, it was like American companies, you know, like 3M all over, you know, that logo was all over the boxes. But yeah, that's how people were able to bring stuff. It was all like donated.
that reminds me that your mom, I mean your Nana, recognized Code Pink, called them the Pink Ladies. Like they have
Yeah.
notoriety, or they're known.
They've been doing work with Cuba for a really long time. They've had so many of these trips to Cuba. This one was just it was on a really large scale. And it was kind of like an emergency mission pulled together because of the blockade. I mean, there are some people who believe that, like, you know, I was in bed with the Cuban government because I went to Cuba. Even like as a writer, writing and interviewing people, interviewing, you know, Cuban Americans, but also interviewing Cubans who live in Havana about what they think. Because at the end of the day, I think their voices matter the most.
Yeah.
They're the ones, you know, who are living, trying to live under an oil blockade, which limits so many things that we daily things that we take for granted in the United States. But I don't know. I think it's the truth is more complicated than people will
Yeah.
give it for.
One person that you talked to, Valdez, mentioned something that like is that really turned my gears, and it's like that, the US can have a friendly diplomatic relationship with Cuba, just like it has with other countries that it doesn't like ideology connect with, like China
Yeah.
and Vietnam. What do you think it is about Cuba that the US has consistently been trying to, suppress?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think if we, I I felt this way for a long time. I think especially I started questioning a lot of the like Cuban American party line on Cuba when like during the Obama years, specifically because I started learning more as well about like how people were living there and how, you know, in certain ways the country has also like been kind of like it kind of stayed in the 20th century. And a big reason for that, there are multiple reasons why, you know, Cuba in some ways is kind of stuck in the 20th century. And one of those things, you know, I mean, their government, like Fidel Castro remained in power. He remained like, you know, the leader of the country for decades. You know, his brother took over for him. Raul Castro, you know, took over as president. They technically have elections, but it's basically like the Cuban people, they elect a Congress, like the National Assembly. And then it would be as if, like, you know, our Congress, if the House of Representatives voted for president in the United States. Like that's a comparison, but even then they are a one party state. So it's like you don't get like a ton of options, and they kind of go for like the nepo babies. So, you know, the current president, Díaz-Canel, was like already part of the Castro's like inner circle. So, in a way, you know, you got a bunch of like old men kind of running things. And hey, listen, we have a bunch of old men. We have no shortage of old men running things in the United States. But yeah, like I think like the limitations placed on like, you know, who's allowed to rise, you know, in when it comes to leadership in Cuba. That's a big question. But I also think that the US embargo has like put so much of it's really like held Cuba back from developing. You know, they've had to rely on Russia for such a long time. For like the entirety of the like you know the communist government's existence there, they've had to rely on like, you know, Russia. I think that's also how it I think that also shaped its politics as well, as like a, you know, to make it a more communist to make it more politically communist. I think it's because they were working with the USSR, and they had, you know, in the early 90s, they had a very similar period of struggle that, you know, to what we're seeing now when, you know, the Soviet Union dissolved, and, you know, like that changed things in Cuba. Then they started working with Venezuela. They were working with China a lot more. And so it's like the thing with Cuba is when it comes to the United States, for one, there is, you know, McCarthyism. It really did a number on people. The Cold War has done a number on people. You know, like there are a lot of people invested in staving off anything that like smells remotely Marxist in the United States. But on top of that, there is also a really powerful lobby of like Cuban Americans in politics who, you know, are on they A lot of them, I think it's a mix. And, you know, like Danny Valdez, who was like one of the founders of Cuban Americans for Cuba, he's also a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. So, like, you know, I say this to kind of give some context for what he said about the US, you know, making deals with China, with Vietnam. Like, there are people who want revenge. You know, he described, and he's someone, you know, his grandparents had their property expropriated in Cuba. There are so many. I'm like giving you kind of like the cutting room floor from like my story is that there were people in the Cuban Americans for Cuba group whose families did have their property taken by the government. And what's interesting, I think at this point, you know, like one of them also, I believe Justine Medina, she acknowledged, you know, that we are far, like the millennials, the Gen Z generation are far enough removed from some of that trauma that we, you know, we might look at it more critically. But it's like there are people like Marco Rubio, for example, proud Cuban American, has never set foot in Cuba. Maria Salazar, same thing, has not been to Cuba, but they inherited the trauma from like their parents, you know, or in some cases grandparents. And I think, you know, even just on a really basic level, it's like, yeah, if my family was like kicked out of my house, like if, you know, just thinking like, yeah, I'd be pretty mad about that. In the grand scheme of things, and these are the conversations I was having with the Cuban Americans for Cuba, because there were some people who, you know, like I would say, you know, there were some people in the group who are socialists, who are communists, and some of them are just like, you know, liberal progressives who just, you know, want to see relations improve with Cuba. They haven't caused the US any harm. There hasn't been any like danger posed by Cuba to the United States, is like kind of the argument that they make. So why are we continuing to punish them through sanctions? There are, you know, lots of there was, you know, there still is debate within the group about like, okay, you know, some of us want to see the communist project grow. Others believe that it should not come, you know, at the expense of the freedom of speech, freedom of expression. You know, people shouldn't have to like move, you know, they shouldn't have to immigrate to another country to be, to write honestly about how they feel in the country, you know, or to run your own business there. I think Cuba, one of the hard parts about writing this story is that because there have been negotiations happening, you know, behind the scenes of all of this, like during the convoy, like Marco Rubio was in talks with Raulito Castro, who is like the grandson of I believe Raul Castro. And so he was in talks, you know, to possibly take over for the president. And we didn't know what was going to happen. Also, like we didn't have any signal. Like I didn't have cell service for like most of the time that I was in Cuba because electricity was like in and out. So like internet wasn't reliable. And it was kind of funny, like once we all got back to Miami, that's when we were catching up on like the news, but also catching up on a lot of like the hate on the internet, from, you know, like a lot of like Cuban exiles or like, you know, their children, different influencers or like activists who were against the Cuban government. Yeah, that was interesting catching up to everything. But even as I was writing this story, you know, in the 2 weeks that it took to like write it, have it edited, have it vetted, and kind of like, you know, fact checked and things like that, this like situations kept changing where Cuba was like, the Cuban government was like, okay, we have a new announcement. We're releasing 2,000 prisoners. And I was like, oh crap, you know? My story was supposed to go up, but now I have to go back and write. Like, okay, they're like releasing a bunch of prisoners. Do we know if any of those prisoners were like political prisoners? By the time my story published, they were still trying to find out. There was no way of there was no like exact calculation for how many people were actually in jail for protesting. And there have been protests in Cuba. So that the best I could do was just be like, yeah, they still don't know, but apparently they freed a bunch of prisoners. And a lot of it was like, you know, people who were in there for theft. Or I think like for political prisoners, something that is a challenge is also like they're not, it's not exactly designated that you're there for like protest, you know, you're not there for like, or it's not like they're not going to spell it out like this person's in there for like thought crime. Like, no. It's gonna be kind of coded. I mean, the way that it is in the United States, like think about all these students who are like, you know, arrested or like, you know, threatened with deportation for protesting the war on Gaza.
There's that one crew that was trying to storm like a ICE facility or like protest it, and they got a lot of them for holding zines, for having like packages of zines.
So I'm saying, I feel like I should say on this podcast, I should say everything with a caveat that I'm also in no way like precluding that the United States doesn't have its own issues. Like you and I both, we complain about it all the time. Even before Trump, you and I were in these Tumblr streets
Girls, don't we
when
know?
Obama was doing the drone wars, okay? Like
Girl, let me tell you, yeah. That's where we
So,
met, essentially, up in these Tumblr, Twitter streets.
yeah. I mean, there are literal laws like banning trans people from using public bathrooms in the United States. So I'm not saying this like, oh, like I'm not coming from like a moral high ground. I'm in the US, so I have, like I have the high ground and everything. Like, no, we don't. But anyway, going back to my story, like things kept changing. It was unclear whether, like Trump would do interviews and they would ask him about Cuba. Meanwhile, he was off bombing Iran. And then he was like, Cuba's next. And it's like, what does that mean? Like, I'm talking to people in Cuba and they're like, he's bombing Iran. Do you think he's gonna bomb us? And I was like, girl, I wish I could tell you. I'm wondering the same thing. Every day it was like, a lot of people were struggling to use the internet. There might be like one person whose SIM card was working, and we'd be like, okay, what's happening? Like every day it was, every day we were there, it was like, okay, what's happening now? And that part is really crazy making. That's the hard part about writing news, writing about current events like this. So my story ended up, I mean, just even from like a practical standpoint, my story ended up having to be more of like a character sketch than it was like a news piece. And so that was something that I really wrestled with because the news kept developing. And after some time, because things kept changing, or like, the Cuban government would be like, okay, we have issued a new decree saying that now if you're Cuban American, you can come here and do business if you want to do business. How they can do that with the embargo, I don't know. There were a lot of like technical issues that still had to be, that still have to be hammered out. So eventually my editor was like, I'm gonna keep it real with you. This cannot be a news article. Like, I was like, people are gonna get upset if I don't mention this, if I don't mention that. And he was like, listen, you are never gonna get the story out if we're constantly having to like wait for more policy updates. Just focus on the people that you went on the trip with and how it made you feel. So my story is not by any means like a comprehensive history or like a news report about the, ongoing like US Cuba struggle happening right now. Tussle, economic war, what have you. It's like not gonna be like the most thorough history because frankly, I would never have gotten this article out. But I did want to get to know people who wanted to help Cuba and like understand the motivations. And I think that something I had to think a lot about was I think something that the Cuban Americans for Cuba kept falling back on, because there is no official like organization-wide stance on the Cuban government itself, because there is diversity in opinion among Cuban American people. And I think that ultimately, yes, they want peaceful relations between the United States and Cuba. But it's like their stance is that they can only do what they can as like US citizens, which is pressure, put pressure on the US government. If we're paying our taxes to the US government and they're like, using our tax dollars to intercept oil tankers to Cuba, this blockade is killing people. That is a fact. You can read it in the LA Times, you can read it in the New York Times. I was also I was not the only reporter there for the LA Times. There was another reporter, Kate Linthicum, who was there at the same time that I was there. And she did a number of interviews with different people in Cuba. Like she really went, she stayed longer than I did. But she was there interviewing just regular working people. And she interviewed, the mother of a man who was arrested during the 2021 protests in Cuba. But and she and her son was still in prison. Her son did not get released from prison. But she also interviewed people who were very scared of Trump. Like in my experience, when I spoke to Cubans on the island, ultimately they were like, "You need to talk to your government." They were like, "Can you talk to?" There was I talked to this woman who had a sleeping baby in her arms, and I felt so bad. She was like, "Tú eres de los Estados Unidos," like. In a very, very thick Cuban accent. It's hard for me to switch between, but like it was really funny. She was like, "Tú, Estados Unidos," and I was like, I'm doing it really badly. But I was like, yeah. And she was like, "Can you tell Trump not to bomb us?"
Oh yeah, I do
And
like that. Like you, whatever it is, like people knew you were their people. Like that's what I got too when I read is that.
yeah, no, I mean, people were like it was kind of fun like walking around with the Cuban Americans for Cuba because like honestly a lot of us could be cousins. Like and even people in Cuba that we talked to could have been related to us, in different ways. I mean, the group was like multiracial, but we were all Cuban American, and it was kind of funny because I think there were like little tells, about like how we were dressed, and also some people like walking around with like, their iPhones. I had a burner phone, out of an abundance of caution as a journalist, but yeah, like there were people talking to us, and they were, and some of them, I mean, there also some people in the group were born in Cuba, so like they were able to blend in a lot more easily, but then some of us born in the US, like still, they were like, "Oh, I knew you looked." They were like, "We can tell that you're American, but
That's
you kind of look
beautiful.
like us." So.
Yeah, I mean, I'm gonna respect your time because I know you're on a time crunch.
I've been,
But
yeah.
it's your time, homie. I appreciate you yapping with us. Is there anything that like, if people that you want people to know that like you wish you can like yell from the rooftops and make sure that everybody knows about what you saw, but what you're hoping. Yeah.
I feel like it was very, very heavy, for me. This was my first time in Cuba. I knew it was going to be really heavy. I always knew that I wanted to go with other Cuban American people because I think it's really important to question everything. And I wanted to question a lot of the things that I was taught. And I think that it's really, really important to understand. And I think there are a lot of us in the United States, we would say the same thing. The people are not the government, especially in Cuba, where it is very limited. The way, that like people have very like multifaceted lives in Cuba. There are different ways for people to engage. When it comes to not just in the government, but in public life, and people there were so kind. And yet they are tired, they're hungry. Unfortunately, there are people who, and I just don't, especially, I didn't agree with it before, but I especially don't agree with this after coming back from Cuba. There are people who believe that the blockade or like the embargo is going to make people desperate enough to overthrow the government. I think that's cruel. I think that is a policy based in cruelty and vengeance. I think people have suffered enough. I don't feel right calling myself Cuban American, or identifying with Cuban anything. while wanting people to starve. And I think that what the United States is doing is harmful. I didn't have to go to Cuba myself to see it. I could have just read, the hundreds of articles that are coming out. And there are people who like believe that they believe in this policy. There are Cubans who think, they should be going even harder. There are Cubans who think there should be no, I'm not even, I didn't meet a single Cuban in Cuba who believed in military intervention from the US. Not a single one. They are very concerned about that. That is their biggest concern. They're not going to go and overthrow the government magically. If they're tired, they're hungry, they don't have electricity, they don't have internet. A lot of people don't have running water. What make like I don't understand what grounds the fantasy that these people are gonna suddenly, poof, decide to get organized if they can't even use the internet. You can't even use the phone. I experienced for myself. I couldn't even organize a freaking breakfast in Cuba if I wanted to. What makes people think that they're going to organize the next revolution and that it's somehow going to be extremely friendly to the US and to capitalism? Because what the United States is doing, it's just making people even angrier at the United States. It is not making people feel any more warm and fuzzy towards Trump or Marco Rubio. It is harming people. And so I think that it would be really, really great if your listeners looked into there is a petition being put forth by the Cuban Americans for Cuba. They have like a letter writing campaign, but it's easy. You just sign it and it's they send letters to different people in Congress just saying, "Hey, enough is enough. I'm asking that you support the motion to end the US embargo." There are multiple bills being put forth by members of Congress, to stop the blockade, but also to prevent like any kind of military intervention in Cuba. These bills already exist, they just need more support in Congress. So that is just like one step that you can take. But I just The thing I want to scream from the rooftops is that, US sanctions are hurting people. They're killing people. And I just like by the end of my trip, I was like, I cannot abide this anymore. Not in my name.
Not in my name. Yeah, I will link the petition in the description of the episode and we'll push it when I promote this episode as well. Yeah, thank you
Thank
for
you.
all that wisdom, all your insights. At the end of your article, I was very emotional when you talked to your grandma and she says, Havana was the Paris of the Caribbean. Can you take me back there? I want to see it again. It's been so long. I was just like, yeah. So thank you for being so vulnerable in the article and yeah, for taking that risk with us for the people to see.
Yeah.
And before I let you go, I have to ask you the question I ask everybody, which is what's
Okay.
made you less bitter as of, as of late?
I think what's made me less bitter is honestly like going to Cuba and meeting people who give a shit, and then coming back to Los Angeles where people give a shit. Like I, living in LA, especially since the ICE raids started really ramping up last summer, I can't say that I live around apathetic people, I don't spend time with apathetic people. I know so many people who find ways to affirm humanity and help people. And what I have seen has been really encouraging, despite, how like frightening the government's actions are. Whether it's the war, whether it's like, the giant concentration camp in South Florida called Alligator Alcatraz. At the end of the day, I know that people are trying to, stop these horrors. And I take solace. I know that this is really serious, but I take solace in the fact that people are still showing up, They're not, we're down, but we're not defeated. That's how I put
Nice.
it.
Yeah. And that's a good way to end. Yeah, thank you for joining us. Yeah.
Thanks, Ruben. I'll
And
see you at karaoke.
definitely, girl, I'm always down. Yeah.
Thanks
All
so
right,
much.
te cuidas. Before we leave, I'm going to give a huge shout out to my I Know Her Level patrons. That includes Fernando Peña, Selena Portera, Miranda Elias, Magdalena Saucedo, Ronnie Leyva, and Bianca Garcia. If you too want to be somebody that I know, feel free to become a patron over on patreon.com/bitterbrownfems. The link is in the description. Bye.